The next speaker is Clyde Awad. Mr. Awad has been with Raytheon Company for 16 years, of which the last 12 has been in the semiconductor division, where here he devotes his activities to the process and product engineering departments. Mr. Awad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Now that you've heard a most enlightening talk on the basic theory of semiconductors by Dr. Lin, and have seen some of the more interesting applications of what you can do with semiconductor technology, we're going to have to roll up our sleeves and get down to work and build this beast. And I think you'll notice in the transition from advanced research to production, there's going to be two things apparent. One is we don't have quite so much leisurely time, and two, no humor. That's it. That's the whole joke. In order to show you this, I'd like to take you on a tour through a hopefully typical semiconductor operation, and have you look through the microscopes of the operators and watch as we build up a slice from a raw material to a finished product. Before we get into this, I'd like to discuss a few of the terms that Dr. Lin discussed on perhaps a little bit more simpler terms. Can I have the first slide, please? Could we have the room lights out? Okay. Now, we want to discuss first what we mean when we say planar, oxide passivated devices. By planar, we mean in apposition to alloy devices, where a junction is on one side and the other junction is on the opposite side of the slice or the chip. Planar means the junction is on the same surface. It is in a plane surface. And you can see there's one junction there and there's another junction here. There's another feature of planar silicon technology, which is a very great advantage to us. One, we can cut openings in this oxide, this protective oxide that is growing across, or that we can grow across the surface. We can cut openings in it in exact and definitive positions. And two, the oxide protects the junction area of the device. The junction area, as you know, is a very, very sensitive area on a semiconductor. It governs the reliability, the characteristics of the device with ambient temperatures and with ambient conditions. And the junction is right there. Now, in order to make this junction, as I said, what we will do is open up openings in this protective oxide. The oxide does two things. One, it prevents ambient conditions from affecting that junction, and two, it allows us to put diffusions into the areas we want to put it into. And as you can see, we've opened it up here, and we've put a into a furnace and diffused down into that opening a gas at a high temperature carrying the dopant, and we form it with ambient temperatures and with ambient conditions. And the junction is right there. Now, in order to make this junction, as I said, what we will do is open up openings in this protective oxide. The oxide does two things. One, it prevents ambient conditions from affecting that junction, and two, it allows us to put diffusions into the areas we want to put it into. And as you can see, we've opened it up here, and we've put a into a furnace and diffused down into that opening a gas at a high temperature carrying the dopant, and we've formed a junction. The junction diffuses down into the slice. It also has one other characteristic. It diffuses sideways, and this is the important thing, because as it diffuses down and sideways, the junction moves over underneath the protective layer of oxide, which was put on under extremely clean conditions. Now, let's get down to the transition from a simple transistor device to a integrated circuit. A simple transistor of just a plain planar type is shown in this second part of this slide. Here you see we have a collector. It's about 5 mils thick, and there's about, say, 10,000 angstroms of oxide on top of it. We have cut into it two openings, and we have diffused in a base here and an emitter here. And as you can see, the junction is not in line with the original oxide opening, but it is out further and it is now protected. These slides are not incidentally to scale. Now, the problem with this particular device is if you want to get a high voltage breakdown from your collector to base, you have to raise the resistivity of your substrate material, particularly your collector material here. This means that in the carriers that are leaving the collector base junction, to get to the outside world, they have to go through a considerable length of relatively high resistivity material. And this causes a voltage drop. When the transistor is on, it's not a perfect switch. You have this area of resistance, which gives you a VSAT, which is not a desirable thing. So how to get around this? Well, we came up with a compromise, and the compromise is shown down in the next slide, next part of the slide. This is what's known as an epitaxial planar structure. Epitax is a Greek word for skin effect, and what it means is that we can grow on top of a slice of silicon. Through diffusion techniques, we can grow another layer of silicon, a skin layer, and we can dope this in any manner we wish. We can make it N-type or P-type. It'll have exactly the same crystallographic orientation as the substrate upon which it was grown. Now you can see what we've done here. We have made our emitter, base, and collector, and our collector now is only about, say, a half a mil in thickness of high resistivity material. So now we have our breakdown voltage. But the rest of the path, 5 or 6 or 7 mils long, to the outside world is very, very low resistivity material. And so we have our breakdown voltage, and we have also gotten rid of our VSAT problem, or lowered it considerably. Could I have the next, please? Now, I'd like to discuss how we went from a planar epitax structure to an integrated circuit. Quite crudely, if you take and put two transistors on one substrate, you have an integrated circuit. But the only problem with this, as Dr. Lin pointed out, is that there is some electrical interaction between them, and you have to separate them. You have to isolate them one from the other. To do this, we cut openings in the oxide, and we drive down a box around each of these active islands of silicon that we wish to grow put our devices in. This isolates on four sides. This is a cross section. It isolates on four sides these N areas. Now, if instead of growing the epi on N-type material, we grow it on P-type material, we have it isolated on top, on the bottom, and on four sides. So this solves that problem. But now we're back in our original box again. You can see right here that the transition from the base collector junction to the outside world is inhibited by the P-type substrate. It can't get through that reverse bias junction anymore than it can get to the transistor on the side of it. So we have to take the collector contact out the top again. In doing so, we've again increased our length of this relatively high resistive path. You can see it now goes over here and up here. And we're back in the old VSAT box again. Well, how do we get around this? Well, we found one other magic way of compromising our process, and we put what is known as a buried layer, or we call it a slug in Raytheon. It's a very low resistivity diffuse layer. It is put in on the substrate prior to the growth of the epi layer. So now when you grow your epi on it, you can now put your active devices right over this low resistivity layer here, and all the carriers will now go through this as it was very low resistance, and then they will proceed up to the surface. Now, this helped a good deal, and if you're really in trouble on VSAT, you can do one other trick. You can have, instead of a horizontal slug or a horizontal buried layer, you can have a vertical one. So now we can have a real short circuit path from that junction area right up to the surface, and we've solved all of our problems, except the yield problem. Now, that'll be all on that, please. There are two processes that we're going to run into throughout the entire manufacture of our device. One is a photolithography process, by which means we put these openings into the oxide. And two, there's a diffusion process. These two we repeat many times. In fact, the photolithography process is repeated about 7 to 10 times on every slice on every product you make. This, in general, gives you a brief illustration of what we do in the photolithography process. We have to coat the surface of the slice with a photosensitive material. This is known as a photoresist, and it is put on in a rather large drop on the surface of the slice is spun at high speed, and the resist thins out to a very thin layer, something in the order of a few microns. And this material is then soft-baked to dry it out, and it is then put underneath a mask on a mask aligner, and the operator registers it with a previous mask and exposes it with an UV light. Now, this is done exactly the way it's done when you make a contact print at home or in your own darkroom. Where the UV light strikes the resist, it polymerizes it. Where it doesn't, it remains soluble. We then take and put it in a developer, and we develop out all the areas that were not exposed. All these areas now will not have any resist on the surface right here. This is the red is the layer of resist over a previous cut. Now, this area here is now going to be bare and will be subjected to either etching or diffusion or whatever you happen to have here. It'll be etching in this case. The resist protects the oxide from attack by etch. The oxide protects the silicon from attack by diffusions. Now, we put this in a an oxide, well, after we develop it, of course, we inspect it. There are many inspections in this operation here. We put it in an oven at a high temperature, and we hard bake it. And by this, we further increase the polymerization, which has already been started by the UV light. After hard bake, it goes into an etch, which consists mainly of a buffered hydrofluoric type etch, and we etch down through the protective layer of oxide, and it's ready to go to another inspection, and we strip off all of the resist that's been on there, wash it, clean it, dry it, inspect it some more, and it's ready to go into a diffusion furnace. Now, this is done, as I said, between 7 and 10 times on each slice in its manufactured. This is the circuit that we're going to make today. It's a Raytheon 215. It's not a particularly new circuit, but it's pretty typical. It's a JK flip-flop. It has 14 resistors, 6 transistors, and 20 diodes, and a couple of capacitors. The capacitors are they're diffuse capacitors, not MOS-type capacitors. You're probably all quite familiar with this. It's a JK flip-flop of the DTL family. I'm going to show you a picture of... Whoops. I guess we skipped something here. Not only that, I think I have it upside down. There we go, okay. This is a picture of what we're going to build. This is what it's going to look like when we get done, and I want you to look at it now. Remember I said there were 6 transistors, and there is one there, 2, those are the output transistors. Then there is another one here and here, and then there are the 2 phase splitters here and here. Those are the 6 transistors. The diodes are here, 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 here. There are several of them. The resistors are these long wiggly lines that you see here. There are more of them right here. And the whole thing is connected together with aluminum wire that we lay on the surface. These 2 areas here are these diffuse diodes, which are diffuse capacitors, rather, which are nothing but large plate-type diodes right here. Now, we're now going to proceed in the manufacture of this device. Oh, boy, I'm afraid I did as poor a job on this as I could have. Could you go back to the slide that you had before this, please? These slides are going to be shown in the following order. There will be a build-up, a paper build-up showing you what we're going to accomplish. Then there will be a photograph, the one before that, please. Then there will be a photograph of the... that's the one, right. It's upside down, but let's not worry about that. This is the paper build-up. It shows the blue is the silicon substrate, and the pink here is the oxide layer on top. Now, to get that oxide layer, we have to skip a couple of slides here, I think, to the one that was on its side. Well, just so we don't confuse the thing, let's go on. The oxide is built on a silicon substrate by putting it in a relatively high temperature furnace, around 1,000 degrees for anywhere from 2 to 4 hours. It's done by bubbling gas, oxygen gas, through DI water for purity's sake and also for speed. It takes, as I said, anywhere from 2 to 10 hours to build up this oxide, which is anything from 5 to 20,000 angstroms, depending on what we're trying to protect against. Now, after we cut this oxide, after we have this oxide, we're going to go through the photolithography process and cut an opening to put in the slug or the buried layer. This shows a slice with the oxide built on it, grown on it, and with the openings cut for these buried layers. Now, when we get to that that first slide I showed you on what we were making, I'll show you where these slugs or buried layers exist in the actual finished product. These down here are merely guides for the aligning burls. This is the slice ready to go into the diffusion furnace for the slug diffusion. Slug diffusion is generally an arsenic or an antimony diffusion. It's done in two steps, a pre-dep and a drive-in. Between the pre-dep and the drive, there's usually a cleanup, which removes all of the impurities on the surface and allows you to do the important thing I showed you at the beginning. You drive in to the slice the impurities that you have put on the surface, but you also do it in a pure furnace, a pure oxidizing atmosphere, so that you can regrow an oxide over those layers in preparation to receiving your second coat. This slice is the same slice after it's been through the oxide, through the regrowing oxide. This has now, it's not the silver color of the silicon, it has a greenish tint of some thickness of oxidation on it. Now we have to strip off that oxide and we have to grow our epi. And this shows the slice with the regrown oxide over it. And now you see the same slice with a buried layer down underneath the epi and with another oxide layer grown over that. We're now ready to go into the next part of our operation. Incidentally, in epi growing is done exactly like a diffusion. We bubble gases through silicon tetrachloride. It reacts with hydrogen and it precipitates out on the surface of the slice silicon and allows the reactants, which are HCl, to go off in the air. This is done at around 1200 degrees centigrade and it takes anywhere from 3 to 10 minutes to grow the layer. We grow something in the order of 10 microns on our devices. Now, we now have this oxide, and these slices now will no longer show you the slug they were designed for an earlier product, and at which time we didn't have it, but let's make like it was still down there. We've now cut openings in here and here, and we're now going to drive down our posts, which will complete our isolation. Now, this shows the slice after having been subjected to the photolithography process and etched out, and it shows the silicon area with no oxide over it out here. This is ready for isolation diffusion, and each of these little paths you see around here are areas that are going to be isolated, leaving these islands in the middle of N-type silicon into which we will put our active and passive components. As you can see now, you might wonder how the girl could see that slug down underneath 10 microns of epi, but it's relatively easy because whatever you have on the surface of the epi translates right up through the surface. If it's a piece of dust, you'll find that out to your regret also. I searched a while to find this device. But now, these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and all of these over here, these dark areas, those are slight depressed portions of the slice where the slug was down beneath the epi. Now I'll show you this slice after it's been through the isolation diffusion. The isolation diffusion is also a two-step diffusion. It's generally a boron oxide or halide, usually the halide. It's done around at a relatively high temperature, close to 1200 degrees centigrade for 10 to 20 minutes. This is also, as I say, it's removed from the DEP process and it's put into a drive-in process where we can regrow our oxide. And here you can see the silver area of the silicon has now have a regrown oxide over it. These colors, incidentally, are actual colors that are not retouched. They are due to the interference of light by the thickness of the oxide that is built on the slice, silicon dioxide being relatively transparent. And the thicker it is, as it gets thicker, it goes through color ranges. These will change from, this was, I think, a pink before, and now it's a blue. Now, how do we know what we've done in the diffusion? Well, we measure it two ways. One, we measure it electrically, and two, we measure it by a bevel and stain technique, or we can do it, in which we can actually take a picture of the diffusion itself and measure the depth to which it has gone. Electrically, we can't do a thing with this thing yet unless we put in a test wafer or unless we wait till the next operation opens up one of those little islands, and we do both. Now, this is a bevel and stain. It shows a some very interesting things here. Number one, this is the surface of the slice up here. And this is beveled at about a 1.5 degree angle, just to magnify the depth to which this has gone. And you can see, this was the oxide opening where we put the isolation diffusion in. And it has driven right down to the P-type substrate. This stuff has a nice characteristic of staining dark if it's P-type and light if it's N-type. So now you can see our N-type islands surrounded by P-type walls to isolate the process. Now you can also notice one other very interesting thing here. The diffusion, as I told you, proceeded downward, but it also goes sideways. You notice up here that this line is not coincident with the line cut in the oxide. It's also shown quite nicely here. To put in our capacitors in this, I said they were just two gigantic diodes. We merely open up the center of these two islands, and that's right down to the bare silicon, and we put it in a boron halide type of diffusion, somewhere around 1,000 to 1,150 degrees for a half an hour or so. Now, prior to, this is a two-step diffusion tool, prior to doing this, if you remember the last slide, these were clear. If we had put a probe down here and another probe here, we could have then tested the effectiveness of our isolation diffusion, because if this was indeed isolated all around, you could put a probe here and here and look at it on a scope and you would see an open or a reverse breakdown of this isolation junction. If it was not, you'd see a short circuit because the carriers would just merely transverse from one to the other. Now this is the same slice after it has come out of the capacitor diffusion furnace, and it has, as you can see, a nice blue regrown area over it. We now have to put in one of the more critical diffusions, which is the base resistor diffusion. This is a build-up showing the cut in the oxide for the base resistor diffusion. Now, the base resistor diffusion is a critical diffusion because here we have to control some of the future parameters of this device. We must control these resistors, which may be a half mil thick, to plus or minus a half a tenth in order to keep it in the type of tolerances that we're looking for later on. Now, you can see the resistors are all cut in their isolated areas, and these areas here are going to be the basis of our future transistors and also the diode bases. Now, the next slide will show this same unit after it has been out of the diffusion furnace, and it has again recovered all of these areas with oxide in preparation for our putting in of the emitter. Now, the emitter diffusion and the N plus contact diffusion is a one-step diffusion. It's done not in two separate furnaces, it's done in one furnace. The main reason for doing this is because we want a very low resistivity on the emitter. And here you can see that we have cut an opening in the regrown oxide, which is that layer, as opposed to the top layer where the base was cut in. We've cut that in the oxide to allow us to put an emitter into that base. We have not opened up anything in the over the resistors or any of the P-type isolation areas where we don't want any diffusion to go in. We have opened up an area over the collector to make the collector contact. Now you might wonder, why do we want to put an N plus diffusion into an already N area? The reason we do this is because, as you recalled from a previous lecture, that we put aluminum over these slices to make the connections, the external wiring. Aluminum is a P-type dopant, and the collector is lightly enough doped that if we're not careful, we can form a junction right at that area between the P-dopant and the lightly doped collector, and this is an undesirable thing. So we over-dope it very heavily with the same diffusion that we put the emitters in, and prevents this problem from happening. The emitter diffusion is a, as I said, a one-step diffusion. It's done around 1050 to 1150. It takes about 20 minutes, and we're looking for a very low V over I. We're looking for a base width in the order of about less than a micron, 7/10 of a micron perhaps. We check electrically in these areas here for this is the slice as it's ready to go in the emitter. Now we can check now for collector base breakdowns, because you see we've opened up some of the collector ring, and we've opened up over the base where we're going to put our emitter. So if we put a probe here and here, we can check to see how well we did on our previous diffusion. Here's the same slice after it comes out of the furnace. And now we're ready for nearly the last step, which will be to cut contact windows in the unit. Incidentally, one thing I haven't showed you here was a lot of you people want high speeds in your operations. And in order to do that, we have to kill the lifetime of the device. We do this by subjecting it to a gold diffusion, and this can be done in any one of three places, depending on what type of electrical parameters you're looking for. Now, this is after it comes out of the oxidation. Next, we have to cut the openings. Oh, excuse me a minute. This is another bevel and stain showing the unit after it has been through the emitted diffusion. Now you can see, here's your substrate, P-type. Here is your surface up here. Here is your isolations driven down here. Here is your base right here. And right in the middle, that light area, is the emitter. Okay? Now we cut an opening in every place we want to make a contact, as you can see here, over the base, over the collector, over the resistors, and we are ready for our metallization. This is what the slice looks like after it has the contacts cut in it. At that time, incidentally, we can check quite a bit of the transistor. We can check its beta and quite a few of the electrical parameters, BVCBO, BVEBO, and so forth. Now, this shows a buildup of the slice as it has received its aluminum. And the aluminum is done in an evaporator. It is built up to about, say, 10 to 15,000 angstroms. Some people build it a little thinner, maybe 5,000 angstroms. And then we put it through a similar photoresist process using different etchants to etch the aluminum away. The resultant slice will be shown here. And that's the same one that we looked at when we first came in. We've finished building this unit. Now, you can now see the aluminum interconnections. This one connects an input diode and also picks up this resistor here and this resistor over here. And you can follow all these paths around. This one goes right over that oxide and prevents a... It allows us to connect this anode here to this transistor base and not short to the plate of that capacitor. Each one of these large areas out here is a bonding pad area where we're going to make a connection from this unit itself to the package. This device is now ready to go into an alloy furnace. This is done something in the order of about 550 to 570 degrees centigrade, relatively low temperature for about 3 to 20 minutes. It makes an alloy occur between the aluminum and the silicon surface beneath it and causes a real low resistance connection with the device. Now, this slice here, maybe you'll recall, is Dr. Lin's tie clip, but this shows an inch and a half slice with many, many of these patterns on them. This particular thing right here is an index mark for the aligning girls, and it's ready to go to a testing machine. And this is 100% electrically tested on a multi-point probe in which we do approximately 30 to 40 tests in a very short period of time. And we can then, if the unit is no good, we put a drop of ink on it, and if it's good, then we don't. And later on, they're separated out by the operators. The next problem that we have here is we have to break this dice up. We have to break this slice up into individual die. Now, silicon has a characteristic very similar to window glass. If you take and scribe it with a diamond and bend it, it breaks, usually. And as you can see, I've got some very nice die here. They're all broken quite nicely. This thing is about 50 mils wide and maybe 75 mils long, something on that order. These dice are selected out now for visual defects and for the electrical rejects, and they're ready to be put on their package. I'm not going to elaborate too much on this because time is running short, and also because some of this was covered this morning, I believe, on a previous lecture. But the die is taken by a girl with a pair of tweezers. This is a flat pack with a gold bottom. It is scrubbed back and forth on this package, which is sitting on a heated post, and it's heated up to approximately 370-72 degrees, and this is the temperature at which a eutectic forms between the silicon on the back of this slice and between the gold on the base of the package. Now, we don't worry about electrical contact because, as you recall, the contacts are all on the top on integrated circuits. None come through the bottom. We would have to worry about how good a ohmic contact we had there. This unit now is ready for bonding. Bonding was also covered, I believe, this morning. It can be bonded in any one of three ways, either gold ball bonded, gold thermal compression bonding, or aluminum wedge bonding. The aluminum bonding is done cold, and these others are done at some elevated temperature, again, close to 300. This one here is a ball bonded unit. It shows that this particular pad, let's see, one of these, the output transistor right here, the output transistor pad is connected by this 1 mil wire to a post on the package from whence it goes to the outside world. And there is about 14 to 16 of these on every unit, and this is, again, has to be done by hand. It's a slow process. The various packages may be used. This one here is an aluminum, ultrasonically aluminum bonded, done cold. It was a reject, as you can see, but I grabbed one for purposes of this illustration. This has got a different type of bond. It doesn't have the round bond. It's done at room temperature. The anvil comes down, and at ultrasonic frequencies, it vibrates back and forth, destroys the oxide interface between the aluminum pad and the aluminum wire, and creates a bond. The next thing we have to do is, in the assembly process, we can forget what we've gone through up here. In the assembly process, after we attach the die and join the wires, we have to treat these through various inspections, washings, sample probings, or sample electrical tests. We then have to seal the unit in a can. There are many units that are sealed nowadays with plastic, but this particular one is a TO5 can that you see here, and the flat packs, that's sealed by welding, ordinary upset welding. The flat pack is sealed by either stitch weld. I believe there are more slides, aren't they? I'm not sure. No, I guess I didn't have any more. Okay. Thank you. The flat packs are sealed by stitch welding and or by brazing, and there are some that are sealed by glass techniques. After the packages are sealed and tested, they are environmentally processed, checking for leaks and checking for the parameter changes at high and low temperatures. This will be covered a little bit more, quite a bit more thoroughly by the next speaker. They are then final tested and are ready to go. There are at least 50 individual steps and at least 500 individual handlings, or can be, in the processing of a semiconductor device. And as you can see, it takes considerable care to produce a device with low cost, high yield, and high overall reliability. Thank you.